Welcome to Anthony Plogue on Music. This is Eddie Ludema, the show's producer, here to introduce Tony's guest for this interview, the inspirational tubist, pedagogue, and author, Richard White. Richard Antoine White, also known as Raw Tuba, is the principal tubist of the New Mexico Philharmonic and Santa Fe Symphony, and is a full professor of tuba at the University of New Mexico. But for bigger reasons than just those, he has been an inspiration for those familiar with his life story and his life work. For the first 4 years of his life, he lived on the streets of Baltimore. Yet today, his life is one of success and of giving. In part one, Tony asks Richard to talk about the early stages of his life, first growing up on the streets of Baltimore, and then being adopted by his grandparents at the age of four, to learning the tuba and getting into the Baltimore School for the Arts, and how that led him to study with David Federle at the Peabody Institute. After Peabody, he continued his studies with Dan Perantoni at the Jacobs School of Music at Indiana University, where he was the first African-American tubist to earn a doctorate. We hope you find Richard's story powerful and inspiring. But before we get to the conversation, we would love to share with you a brief message from our sponsor friends at Dorico, the cutting-edge notation and engraving system software from Steinberg.
Create music that moves with Dorico 5, the brand new version of the music, notation, and composition software from Steinberg. Packed with new features throughout the application, it's the perfect time to update from your current version or to try Dorico for the first time. You can start for free with Dorico SE or Dorico for iPad, which now allow projects with up to 8 players, or step up to Dorico Elements, which now allows projects of unlimited size and features an expanded engrave mode. For professional use, choose Dorico Pro, which has many unique features you won't find in any other software. Visit www.steinberg.net/Dorico today and make more time for music.
Richard Antoine White, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start this in a way that I have not begun a podcast before, and that is I'm calling out a YouTube video that you did. It's called I'm Possible with Richard Antoine White and Lawrence Brownlee, where the two of you did a discussion for about an hour or something like that. And I thought this was just such a fantastic interview discussion. Number one, the content was great. Number two, you've known each other and been very good friends for most of your lives, and so the love and respect was audible. You could really hear that. But number three, you guys just laughed almost constantly, and it was so great to hear. And just to listen to an interview where there's so much laughter but also so much really moving material was great. So for people listening to this, I would really refer you to, hopefully we'll have a link at the bottom of the page that we have for you, and it's a wonderful interview. But I would like to talk a lot about your story. And so the beginning is you were a premature baby, and you and hard to imagine, you're 6'5 now, but you were just a little bit over a pound when you were born. Is that correct?
That is correct. I was so small you could put me in your hands and close them.
Wow, really?
Wow. Yes.
Amazing.
Incredible.
And was there a concern about your survival at that time? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how many months premature I was, but my adopted dad eventually would come and tell me stories, and he would say, I felt so bad for you. You had tubes coming out your nose, out your head, and everywhere. You were just so small. We laugh about it now, but you know, that incubation process has gotten so advanced nowadays. But back in the 70s, it was just kind of starting to get advanced. So the survival rate was pretty, I call it a miracle. It's pretty significant, you know, to have survived that.
Yeah. I mean, there was so much that it's sort of a miracle that you survived. I mean, I forget. 2 months sticks in my mind, but I could be wrong on that, where I think you still have scars from being, in a way, I guess you could say, eaten by a rat or bitten by a rat when you were, yeah, if you could tell that story.
Yeah, that's not too far for what you're talking about. You know, I left the hospital premature, mom in and out of living situations. We didn't, I think you call it intermittent homelessness. When you don't have a home, you just sleep where you can. And I was left in an abandoned building that actually caught fire. I don't know if she was getting her fix or whatever, but rats started chewing on me on the side. I still bear a scar from that. And ironically, my uncle came and shot a 22, little 22 shotgun because neighbors called and was like, hey, something's not right here. And he thought I would lose my hearing. So the irony of that is later on, I became a musician, right?
Yeah,
it worked
exactly.
out. I did not lose my hearing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yes, I do bear the scar still.
Do you have any memory of that at all? I mean, you were so young.
Oh, no. And you know, when people check out my film or my book, it's interesting because one of the questions, you know, is making sure that everything is valid, the validity. And lucky for me, people are still living. I'm not so old that you can't go find out the history. So I know that event happened because it was explained to me by my uncle who came to rescue me.
Yeah. We'll have a link to your book as well, which is an incredibly great book. And one thing that I guess a surprise for me a little bit was normally if you think of an alcoholic mother who in a way almost like on a daily basis abandons her baby, you tend to have a negative view of her. But I came away with a really strong feeling for your mother that in spite of all of her problems, there was something about her that really, really moved me. Not only just her giving you away at the age of 4, but even before that, just how she wanted to be with you, but sort of couldn't because of her addiction also?
I think that's a very powerful assessment. You can't underestimate the power of music itself. We didn't have much, but she sang to me all the time. And I think looking back, I think that's the greatest gift she gave both me and my brother. You know, later on in life, we got to collaborate and make some music together. And we were reflecting. I was like, man, this is a great gift that she passed on to us unknowingly. And when doing that initial time, I have to tell you, I was angry at her because when I went to live with my foster parents, all I thought is, hey, you took me away from the one person I love the most in the world. Being older, I think she was a hero because she did one of the most difficult things there is to do, and that's to give a child up so that they could have a better life. So she's my hero.
Yeah. And in a way, I guess that's to accept your own frailties or mistakes and maybe to accept that I may not be able to get any better. What did she sing for you? Do you remember what she was? It lullabies?
Oh, man. My biggest memory is I loved Greece, so she would always sing Go Greece Lightning or Sandy, whoa.
Really?
I remember it like it was yesterday. Oh. Go Greece Lightning, go. We would sing that. You know, I should probably look up to see when Greece came out. Because it had to be very popular in the early 70s because that's what she sang to me.
Wow.
And then there was Minnie Riperton, Loving You.
Oh, yeah, I remember that with the extremely high part. Yeah. Yeah. That was, I think, around 1974 to 76, I think, something like that.
Well, that would make sense because my time there, I was born in 73 and was adopted in 78. So that fits the timeline. I don't know about Greece, though. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah. I think that was maybe a couple years afterwards, but maybe. But I remember the Minnie Riperton that I was playing with the Utah Symphony. I played 2 years with the Utah Symphony, 74 to 76. And I remember hearing that a number of times, you know, when I was with the orchestra.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think that's probably
amazing.
Right. Yeah, about the dates. So when your mother gave you up, you were angry at your mother at the time. But first time, maybe let's go back and talk about what your life was like before your mother gave you up, because we really haven't talked about that. How you would be looking for food during the day, trying to find a quarter someplace or several quarters that you could get 99 cents for a meal or something like that?
Yes. I was not an angry kid despite the things I didn't have. I didn't know any better. You know, sometimes they say ignorance is bliss. Maybe that's the case. In Baltimore City, and I think in a lot of cities on the East Coast, because of the rain and the location near the water, you have these things called sewer drains. And so it's basically where water runs along the sidewalk. And money ends up in these things all the time. So I would walk the city searching the water drains, finding quarters to go to the open market, a lot of cities, Pennsylvania and in Maryland, have what's called open markets, where you, if literally, I'm not joking, if you want to go buy a shark, you can go to the open market and probably find one. So I would get just enough coins to get maybe a piece of chicken, a chicken gizzard or whatever. And that would be my meal for the day. And so my day consisted of playing like any other normal kid. I ran around the streets barefooted, finding enough coins to get some food and searching for my mom, because we often got detached. And I would chew that food because I didn't know if I would find money or have food the rest of the day. And I would chew it under my tongue. And then if I didn't find food later on, that's what I ate. Wow. Don't ask me how I was that resilient in making things happen. I think sometimes the new universe gives you natural ability to survive, and I'm grateful that it did that for me.
I'm wondering if also maybe because that's the first thing that you were used to, you didn't realize what life would be like. And when you went in with your grandparents then, that it, which was a more disciplined life, you had trouble with that at the beginning.
Well, I think they're there too, because I mean, I really didn't know that you get your own bed, what you're supposed to do with a bed that was your own. So when I had my first bubble bath, I climbed out of it and climbed out of those things called pajamas. I didn't know what those things were. And I put my dirty clothes on and slept on the floor because that's what I was used to. You know, I talked to myself in the mirror because I was so angry at them that I made myself my best friend.
Uh-huh. And I mean, a great story, I think, is when you were, you had it, I guess, with the discipline, because they brought discipline into your life and you really didn't like that at all. And you said, I'm out of here. I'm going to leave. And that's a great story of what your grandmother did with you.
That's crazy, because we just talked about that story in my own family yesterday.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, for the listeners, I decided I had enough. I was going to leave. She said, well, let me help you. So she started packing the bag. And then I got to the door and she said, oh, wait a minute. Let me see that bag. I bought those shoes. I bought these shirts, and start taking everything out the bag. And then she handed me the bag. And I said, I changed my mind.
That was pretty fast. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the discipline they installed in me. I think it has a lot to do with who I am today.
Yeah, they sound like really, I mean, your mother to me sounded like a really remarkable person in her own way, but also your grandparents for sure.
Yes.
Sounded that way.
And dad is 93.
Really?
By the way, still living. We just moved him to independent living, got him an apartment. And I talk to him every day. I send him fruitcake and pimento cheese. He loves that. I want no parts of that, but that's his snack.
Wow. Okay. How great. That's great. And that's great that you're keeping in touch so much every day. That's wonderful.
Yes.
And so how long did it take you to really sort of get used to that discipline and fit into it, a different lifestyle where you're not roaming the streets, where if they give you a sandwich, you can eat the whole sandwich and you don't have to store half of it for later on?
To their credit, it took a long time, but they had a way of raising me because they had their own fear that once I was of age, I would leave and go find my mom. So they decided that they would make sure I could take care of myself. And so that means they would take the milk from the big gallon jug of milk and put it in a jar so I could make my own cereal. They would put the bread on the lower shelf so I could get the bread and learn to make my own sandwich. And I think alongside of that, there were consequences and rewards. So the rewards were, you know, along with this discipline, you had to work, you had to clean stuff around the house, but you got what was called an allowance. So what kid doesn't want money? If I want, you know, a G.I. Joe toy or whatever, I could clean the yard and make a little money and go get that toy. And then there were consequences. When you didn't do what you were supposed to do, there was no TV, no video game or whatever your pleasure was. It was taken from you and you had to earn it back. And so much so, I know you know the story of me playing the trumpet. I played trumpet and I was failing in school. And I loved band, I loved the trumpet. So they took the trumpet. And they said, if you want this trumpet back, you have to turn your grades around. I wanted that trumpet, man. I never failed a class since.
Really?
So I got that trumpet back. And that was their way of raising.
Wow, that's great.
Because you have a hard job. The trumpet, I mean, it was like 32 of them. And I was like number 18. I was like, this ain't working out.
I can only shudder when I think of what 32 trumpets would sound like at that
goodness.
Age.
Giant middle school. I looked up and saw one sousaphone. I don't know what that is, but it's only one. I want to play that.
That's great. And that changed your whole life.
It did.
It's funny how that works. One thing I forgot to ask you, and maybe you could just describe, was, and I think this is what got you to your grandparents, when you were roaming the streets, you said you went barefoot quite often. During the winter, one time you got caught in a blizzard and almost died.
Oh, it wasn't just a blizzard. It was a historical blizzard. I think all up and down the East Coast in about 1978, because I was four. I couldn't find her. And so I was roaming the streets. And, you know, the thing is, it wasn't by choice that I didn't wear shoes. You know, I often had to go get shoes at the thrift store or wherever we found them, and they weren't the right size. So we would stuff newspaper in the front of them and so I could fit them. And obviously, that's not a good system. They always came off. So I just said, to heck with these shoes, and walked around. But as you know, in a snow blizzard, you're going to get frostbite or whatever happens. I couldn't find my mom. I ended up in a vestibule. That's the space between the actual house. I woke up the next morning. The authorities had found me. The people at the house let me in. I was in a blanket, tea all around, and the authorities was discussing this serious situation. What are we going to do? And obviously they did things, because on everybody's mind was, oh, it's a matter of time before we find him like this and he won't survive. And that's how I got to my foster parents. They made calls, called around, and it's a tricky story to follow, because the people that adopted my mom eventually are the people I call mom and dad myself, adopted me.
And when they said, call us mom and dad, that's one of the things that really made you change your feelings towards them, correct? In terms of the discipline and all of that?
You really did your homework. Yes.
Well, the book was great. I mean, I've listened to some of the interviews too, you know, so.
It was a major turning point. It was emotional. And I don't even know what sparked that, because prior to that, and I'm not sure I put it in the book, Tony, I have to tell you, I went to Sunday school, and the Sunday school teacher told us to go home and tell your parents that you love them, because we don't do this enough. So I went home and told my parents, mom and dad, I really want you to know I love you. Grandma and granddad at that time. I really want you to know I love you. And they looked at me and said, boy, what do you want? Or what did you do? And I was like, I didn't do anything. The Sunday school teacher said to come home and tell you I love you. And then a few weeks later, they called me in the room and said, we want you to call us mom and dad.
Wow. That's great. That's really great. That's really great. And the fact that you've had such a great relationship with them since, you know, your mom has passed away, but your father is 93, you said?
Yes, yeah. 93.
Wow. That's great. That's great. Well, when you finally made your switch to, sousaphone before the tuba, but you had a trumpet player friend whose name is Dante Russo. And that's where you met him in school. I think that was maybe fourth grade.
Yes, I guess this still happens. The music teacher came to the school with every instrument known to man. Uh-huh. And I don't know if trumpet players think the same way, but I said, hey, man, we got to pick the trumpet. It only got three vowels. It's got to be easy. Boy, was I wrong.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It can be difficult, that's for sure.
Yeah. So we started trumpet together in fourth grade and remained friends until this day.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, after middle school, then you auditioned for the Baltimore School of the Arts, and that was a pretty amazing, if you would call it, audition. You know, who was it that said, I forget who said this, but something like half of success or 80% of success is just showing up. So you showed up. Unfortunately, it was the wrong day. Yeah, but that might have been in your favor, perhaps, because you had a one-on-one with this person.
I look back on that and like, how is that possible? So not only did I show up on the wrong day and the school wasn't supposed to be open, I showed up wearing a sousaphone with crutches, knocking on the door. And the director had left the score. He just happened to be there. And he says, "What are you doing here, young man?" And I said, I came to audition. He said, "Auditions was yesterday." And I don't know where I had the audacity to say it, but I looked him right in the eyes and said, "But I'm here now." And he said, with that kind of attitude, "I had to hear this, young man."
That's great. That's absolutely great. It's absolutely great.
It went right over my head. Auditions were yesterday, so.
Yeah. And you couldn't, at that time, you couldn't even read music, but he would play something and then no. you would sort of play along, play what he had written.
Yes, I'm going to push our ages here. You remember cassette tapes, right? And so there used to be this very famous cassette tape that was black and it had buttons on the front. Play, rewind, stop,
oh, yeah,
or whatever.
Sure. Uh-huh.
So back in the day, Hal Lennox had a band series where you would put the cassette tape in, it would go boo, this is B flat, play B flat, boo, pause the tape, when you have mastered B flat, go to C, boo boo. That's how I learned.
Okay,
that's really, and of course as a kid, it's not like I had the manuscript in front of me. Of course I'm gonna take the easy right. Well, I'm just gonna listen to the note and play it. I don't know what these black dots are, so I learned by just listening to the cassette tape. The book was available, but I decided not to use that.
So you learn more on your own than actually at the school.
Yes, we had practice rooms. So I would crawl into that Frankenstein sousaphone chair, press the tape, and that's how I learned. Because
wow.
The band director had so many kids to teach.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so if you were a beginner, he would be working with the band, and the beginners would be assigned practice rooms with the tape recorder. That's why I couldn't read music. And I think it's called rote. They taught a lot by rote back in that days where you have the manuscript in, but they play it and then you play it back.
And that was sort of your audition then also, that you could actually play back what this person played for you.
Yes, it worked out in my favor because he was like, "This is amazing." I was like, "This is what I do all the time."
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
He was thinking like, "Whoa." I was like, "Oh, I had practice in this." And it's really funny because he said he played in E flat, but he kept asking me, "What is this?" And I said, "It's one." And he said, "Yeah, but do you know the name of it?" I said, "Yeah, it's this, it's first valve." He said, "No, but do you know the name of that note?" And I was getting annoyed. I said, "Yeah, man, it's first valve." He said, "Well, it's actually E flat."
Uh-huh. That's great. You know, do you know the quote from Louis Armstrong? And I don't have this as an exact quote, but it's a great quote that somebody asked him, "Can you read music?" And he said, "Well, yeah, a little bit, but not enough to get in my way," which I think is a great way of looking
amazing,
at things.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's really good. Well, so you learned how to read when you were at the Baltimore School for the Arts. That sounds like an amazing experience of number one, in a different way, sort of being taught discipline. And you said they even worked with you like on how to speak, which you interpreted mm-hmm. as being they wanted you to speak like a white person.
Yes, I was very rebellious. It's crazy how it makes full circle because the one person that really pushed me there was Carolyn Fox, and she's a trumpet player. She told me that the better tuba player shouldn't be beating you. You're too talented. Why don't you work? Why don't you show them that you can do this? And it changed my whole outlook because I had felt a sense of belonging in the School for the Arts, even though there was this kind of rebuttal against them changing my characteristics. But in that moment, it was the first time on a music level that someone showed me that they really care, but they wasn't going to do the work for me. And it changed my work ethic. She didn't say, "You're not practicing. This is unacceptable. You need to get it together." She said it in a way, "Why are you letting these other people beat you? Why don't you do the work?" And it just resonated in such a powerful way. And it's like, "Well, I can do the work. Wait, hold on. I'm in control here. Time out." And literally, Tony, that's uh-huh. that's when I start getting to school at 7 o'clock in the morning to practice because I had this idea, I can do it. I'm in control. prior to that, I didn't think I was in control.
Well, there's one quote of yours, I think, was that has to do with working harder than anybody else. You know, if you want to get what you want. And there was that corresponds exactly to a time I was in the Indianapolis airport, and I had some free time before catching my flight. And there was an interview with Derek Jeter, the great baseball player.
Yes.
And I didn't know that much about him, but I read this interview, or it's actually a story. And evidently when he was in his first year, he went to training camp. And first time with the Yankees and all of that, a young man. And after about 2 weeks, he called his mother and said, "Mom, I'm coming home. These guys are so talented. I just don't have a chance with this team." And his mom said, "Well, they all may be more talented than you, but there's no excuse for any of them working harder than you." And of course, he ended up being, isn't that a great story? He ended up being like this unbelievably great ball player. And that's exactly the same quote that you use.
I believe that because, you know, I call them 0 hours. By me getting up at 7 o'clock, everybody else came to school at 8 when school was supposed to happen. So what happens is that extra hour just builds and builds. So after a couple years of doing that, they couldn't catch me. I was so far ahead because those morning hours added up. And I think it applies to any sport, anything you're doing. And I realized that, okay, it's always going to be someone to play higher, faster than me, but boy, no one's going to outwork me.
Yeah, yeah. That's such a great way to look at things. I think that is really fantastic. So a question about when you were at the School of the Arts in Baltimore, is that when you started to usher at the Baltimore Symphony?
Yes.
Or was that after you went to Peabody?
No, it was at School for the Arts because I federally came to Baltimore School for the Arts, and I had never heard a tuba player sound like this. David Federley, former principal of Baltimore Symphony. He studied with Arnold Jacobs, so, you know, he had that sound. And I was like, whoa. And so it was more of a financial issue. I didn't have money to buy tickets to the symphony, but after hearing him, I knew I needed to hear that sound. After that masterclass, I was like, wow, I need to hear that every day so I can copy it. So I went and got a job as an usher at the Meyerhoff. So I would leave Baltimore School for the Arts. I think school got out at 4:10 and the concerts were like 6 or even later. I would hang out, sometimes practice, and that's how I got to hear all the symphonies. And I would ask him questions after every concert. How'd you sound like this in this part? How'd you do this? He said I was the most inquisitive student he has ever had, and to the point where he just gave me the pass to the back room of the Baltimore Symphony in Meyerhoff Hall.
That's great.
So, I mean, I must have burned a hole in his ear asking questions, but I could close my eyes to this day and hear his sound.
Wow. So when you were an usher, did that mean that you were there Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon, or did you just do one night a week?
No, I was there all the time.
Wow.
So the crazy thing is you have to be careful, but, you know, you're in the hall as an usher. So if it's the symphony, and sometimes it would be no tuba, I could do my homework. If it's a big tuba part, I have my ear to the door, right?
Right.
It was a perfect balance.
Could you sneak in and if there was a seat empty and just sit in the seat?
Yes. So sometimes if you had to have someone seat in between a movement, you could get them in there, and then you were allowed to stand in. You weren't supposed to, but you could say, "Hey, I didn't want to disrupt the patrons." So I did that. I pushed the envelope on that rule a lot.
Yeah. That's great. I remember when I was in college at UCLA going to an LA Philharmonic concert, and the second half they played Don Juan. And I had tickets way in the nosebleed balcony section looking down. I think it was in the second row. I saw like about 3 or 4 seats that were empty on the first half. So I went down for the second half, and I mean, it was great, but I was so stressed thinking that somebody was going to come in and, you know, take those seats. And then I was in front of the entire audience. But, you know, I made it through the concert. So.
Well, if you read my book, so I got in trouble. You know, I call it the dream killer in a book. Do you remember this part?
Is this the guy that said you'll never be on stage?
Yeah,
but you had your revenge. So tell that story. That's a great story because, first of all, I would think that somebody would have the opposite reaction if they see somebody who's so intent on the music and is going backstage and is there all the time that you would say,
yeah,
one day you're going to be on this stage. But this person said, right. What did this person say?
I call this person a dream killer because I did get in trouble. Richard, you're supposed to be in the hall ushering, not in the hall listening to the concert. So I was on the edge all the time. And I said, okay. So he told me one day, I guess he was fed up. He said, well, you're never going to be on that stage. You need to do your job. And that's what you're paid for. And so I said to myself, one day that guy is going to bring me a glass of water and I'm going to be on that stage. And so just so happened, Baltimore Symphony program Berlioz Requiem, which has four tubas. So my odds went up. We got hired as subs to play Berlioz Requiem, and Dream Killer was on the stage, and they said, anyone need water? I was in the balcony, and I raised my hand and said, yes, I would like water, please. And he had to bring me water.
That is so great. That's
so
wonderful.
Revenge.
Well, talk about your lessons, yes, with David Federle. What did he work on? How many years were you with him?
4 years.
4 years, okay.
I think I was with him from 92 to 96. And I guess what I want to share most is that what I learned from him, I call him the truth teller style of teaching, is that he tells you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. And every lesson with him, I would say the most valuable lesson I learned is that the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off, but then you'll be better for it afterwards. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. That's how I describe every lesson. He was honest. He was, he held the highest level of excellence, with music always being first. I left every lesson and cried because I wanted to achieve so bad. But I think he was taught well by Jacobs to put the music first. So it was never personal. I knew that this was about the music, that it was bigger than me. And, you know, subconsciously, I didn't want to let him down. I didn't want to let myself down. And now that I'm older, I didn't want to let the composer down. I would look at these etudes and stuff like, how am I supposed to know how that's supposed to go? Or how did I spend all week practicing that? And I was a third off, you know? So being a hustler on the street, after that first year of hard lessons, I was like, this isn't going to happen. I took the first 10 etudes of every book and got ahead so that when school started, he was signing the etudes. I was on number 3. But I had already practiced up to maybe number 12.
Wow. Okay.
And so I was always ahead, and I started getting real good. So because I couldn't fit in, I was so deficient that I couldn't fit what I needed to fit in. But I figured out how to get ahead every book, you know, and now my kids have lessons. We're all much older and they're like, you know, all of these, I said, in every single etude book I can play because I played every single one of them. I did not start excerpts until my junior year of college.
When did he finally tell you that, or when did you finally tell him, rather, that you actually prepared in advance? You had gotten this down like during the summer or whenever?
He said, I'm not surprised. I think it was a junior year because I think my junior year, I would always get my butt kicked by Beth Chenard. She's a very talented tuba player.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
In Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, in California, not Chicago. And so I think my junior year, I actually won the audition and wasn't given it. He said, no, man, you played your butt off. But she had earned seniority or veteran status, whatever you want to call it, where she paid her dues. So it was her chair. And he said, your preparation is finally paid off. The same way you figured out how to prepare the etudes, you now figured out how to prepare the excerpts. And he wasn't wrong. I went online and I could get records for 99 cent. I went crazy. And they were just coming in like you wouldn't believe. And this was right when they were about to go out and the new technology or whatever was coming in. It just would have been in the 90s. So, man, I got these 99 cent records, tried to find the part in Mahler where the solo was, and I never looked back. I start preparing the excerpts just like I was preparing the etudes. And I think he said to me, it's time for you to leave. I've given you the tools that you need. Now you need to go somewhere where you can be taken to the next level. And the criteria was very simple. you need to go to a school where tubists are getting a job. And during that time, I was talking to Ed Goldstein, my first teacher, and said, hey, man, Frederick says I need to go to Indiana, Michigan, and Northwestern because this is where the people are getting jobs. And he says he thinks I'm good enough. And Ed Goldstein gave me a dose of reality. He said, you're pretty good. And he said, you probably go there and be a pretty good tuba player, but I want you to know that I don't know anybody that's hiring good and very good tuba players these days. I went, whoa, time out. Right? I say that to myself this day, to my students, to myself, when I feel like I'm not offering the world my very best. Very good and good is really not cutting it these days.
Yeah, especially for tuba players.
Yes, it's gotten unbelievable. And that resonates in my head that Ed said that at a time when Federley said, it's time for you to move on.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I hadn't thought about this before. But when he said it's time to move on, in a way, that's a little bit like your mother, like pushing you out, you know, pushing you towards something better for you.
Yeah, we became really close, and he would tell students that was auditioning, I think you should go somewhere else. If you come here, one of the reasons you would come here is because of Richard, but I'm telling him to leave. And a couple of students told me that he told them that, and I was like, wow. You know, I don't know. I just had this sheer determination and resilience. Also, because he was so hard on me, I knew that I had an unlimited amount of times to get it right before the next lesson, and I took advantage of it.
When you ended up going to Indiana, and you studied with Mr. P, Dan Pierantoni.
Yes.
And I don't know Mr. Federley, David Federley, at all. I do know Dan very well. And it seems to me like, just from what I know of Dan, I haven't seen him teach that much, but just knowing him from the Summit Brass and staying with him and playing in a brass quintet with him, I mean, Dan's a really great guy and a really funny guy, but I can't see him as being like maybe super hard on his students. But you say that at times he would really let you know that, you know, you can do better or that you have to do better.
Yeah, I think, you know, there have been different teachers in my life. And the audience wouldn't know this, but I have a third book coming out. The second book is a picture book explaining diversity through the instruments of the orchestra.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And just to share with you, the main purpose of the book is no matter whether you play jazz, hip-hop, New Orleans, classical, that no matter what your ethnicity is, black, Asian, whatever, we all choose from the same set of 12 notes. Look what happens when we come together. That's the premise. But the third book is the five educative languages of teaching and administration. And there's the dreamer, which is Mr. Harvey Phillips. There's the storyteller, which is Mr. Richard Burns, my very first teacher at elementary school, the one that gave me the cassette tape. And then there's David Federley, who we talked about, the truth teller. There's Ed Goldstein, who's the freestyler, you know, Dixieland and all that playing. And then, who we're talking about there, there's Mr. P, who's the motivator.
Uh-huh,
you know, okay. Mr. P, will, you go to him and you see how his students, when he, you have a lesson with him and you come out and the Rocky theme is playing in your head. Dun, 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 dun. That's how you feel, you know. And then, when I say sometimes he came down hard, he would go, son, how'd the audition go today? He's Italian, so everyone's son, right? You know, Mr. P. And you would go, I think it went okay. He goes, but you didn't win. Let me hear it. And then, you know, you get your tuba, you show him. He goes, that's pretty good, son, but you don't own it. And I was like, own it? Yeah, and then we would have this, because how many excerpts do you own? And I was like, well, I don't think I own any of them. And what I learned from Mr. P is don't lower your standards to meet your expectations, but raise your expectations to meet the ultimate level of excellence.
That's great. Did he put that into words?
That's just me interpreting what he did for me over the years and his style of teaching. But that's what it is. He will drive you. I mean, you'd be sitting there and you're like, I can't play any more low E's and found. He said, come on, you got 20 more. And he's like, what's that kid that just won? What's that kid that just won the national? Said, yeah, is he going to get tired? He's like, all right, I guess I'll do it 10 more times. Mr. P is one of those teachers that will give his students everything. He does not hold back, and he wants you to be better than him, or at least as good as him. And I think that's what makes him special.
Wow, that's great. That's great. I just remember playing in the Summit Brass, where the tuba section was Gene Picorni playing the bottom octave and then down on top. Unbelievably great.
Wow. Yeah.
And
you just turn around and go, that's how that goes.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I always think about is the first piece that we would play to start a concert would be the Royal Fireworks music of Handel, like some excerpts from that.
Yes.
Starting in D major and starting with a D in octaves, which I think the basses and Shelley would play, but that just Dan and Gene would play in octaves. And it was probably maybe not a big deal, but every night it was like an organ, and it just sounded round and beautiful and great. But thinking of these two great players in this really great group, when I think back, basically, again, I just sort of think of the laughter and the jokes, Dan telling jokes that would have the entire bus, like on a tour, in stitches, you know, or Gene, the same thing. And really, I think... I'm not a tuba player, so tell me if I'm right or wrong, that they're maybe because of the instruments, but their styles of playing were different. To me, Dan's a very light or lighter, elegant, sort of a chamber music player, soloist, and Gene has this huge, fat sound that's, makes him the greatest orchestral player, at least in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
I would say those characteristics are correct, but I think they share the same three principles. And I follow this in my own teaching philosophy. There are really three rules to this game if you want to be great. And that's always have fun, always sound great, always make great music. There's not a great player that doesn't fit that script, in my opinion. Brad, when we talk about the legends of brass player, they all fit into those three things. Like you said, you'll see them laughing. You'll see them. It's all about the hang just as much as it is the music. Like, oh, well, this hang part must be really important.
Yeah.
They enjoy it. And they always sound good. Like, I think to the point where I've believed that without sound, you have nothing. And they always make great music.
Well, while you were studying with Dan, you auditioned, I think it was three times for the New Mexico Symphony Orchestra. And it was the third time that you got it. What was the progression that you made that allowed you to get good enough to get the job the third time around? And what were you lacking the first and second time, do you think?
A few things happened. First, the Boston Symphony audition happened. And back then you had to, here we go with the cassette tape again. This is a running thing. You had to send in tapes. And they had received 174 tapes. And they picked three, and my tape was one of them.
Wow. This is New Mexico or Boston?
This is Boston Symphony, okay. And they had to audition twice before Mike Roylands won. But they had 174 tapes, and my tape was one of the three that was picked. And I knew of Doug Yeo because he played in Baltimore during my younger years, so people would talk about him. But that told me the truth about where my plan was, and I had the evidence. I recorded that tape so much that when I got to the final product, I could actually do what was on the tape. And so from that experience, what changed as I was taking these auditions is that I learned how to eliminate the guesswork. I made a list of everything I could do and couldn't do. I was reading Don Green's audition success book. So I put all my excerpts in three categories. Excerpts that I know I don't know. Excerpts that if I have the perfect orange juice, perfect coffee, it might just come together. And then excerpts that I own, I can play no matter what. And then I tried to move everything to category one. And that's what really changed during this to Mexico. And the last thing was I got into trouble in Robertello's orchestral rep class. Chris Lee, who's the principal tubist of Ottawa National Symphony in Canada, we were in class and we were describing somebody's excerpt, and Chris used some profanity, and the teacher said, "Ugh, how dare you insult me and the ladies?" And Chris responded by saying, oh, just you and the ladies, not the rest of us. And I bust out laughing, and we got in trouble. And he decided to punish us. He said, I'm not going to have this. This is a serious class, and you guys will play every day for everyone at the start of every class. And we were like, great. Fantastic. So every class, we had to start by having a Bach audition, and it was either him or me that was start. It was the best thing. So we were playing every class. So the excerpts became automatic, and we were hearing things that we never heard because the class was mixed. Flute players, oboes, trumpets, trombones. So we heard all kinds of perspectives, but we had to be ready to go. And by the time the third New Mexico Symphony came around, we were at the end of that class. I think he won Winnipeg, I won New Mexico, and the rest is history.
Wow. Okay. So that's a vote for profanity then, I guess.
Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, sometimes someone laughing is like a disease. You can't stop laughing.
Yeah, sure.
Just like, we couldn't cut it off. I tried. I was like, this is not good.
That's great. Do you know the Mike Roylant story about how he won Boston with the De Meister Singer overture?
No, tell me.
It's such a great story. I heard this on an interview with him. And he just seems like an absolutely wonderful guy. That he was doing the audition and everything was, you know, going fine. Obviously, he won.
Yeah.
And he turned the page and the next thing was the Meister Singer. And he thought to himself... The future of my unborn child depends on the way I play this excerpt. Can you imagine that? And he won. He won the audition. I mean, I thought that, I would totally fold. So
no, he sounded like $1 million. I've been at a couple auditions with him and Curl, and my thought was, wow, I could sound like that if I practiced a whole lot more. Right? It's just... it's meant to be. And I think I tell my students that it's hard to compete someone that's worrying about how they're going to pay rent, taking care of a kid, taking care of a wife. I say, that's what your very best means. You have to leave no question that that is your absolute best, because somebody else got some intangibles that you ain't going to see coming, you know? And I think that's sometimes life sucker punch you. And when you get sucker punched, you realize what I think happened to Mike is, in order to get to somewhere you've never been, you have to do something you've never done. And I think in that moment, he realized that golden rule.
So you worked extremely hard on your excerpts and on playing the tuba. Did you also have to work on the mental aspect in terms of like being nervous and controlling your nerves for an audition? Or was that something that was pretty natural for you?
The more I practiced, the less nervous I was. And, you know, we coined the 7 P's after Mr. P. Prior proper planning prevents piss poor performance. So I walked around saying it all the time. So it's called the 7 P's, and we made it in school after Daniel Parentone.
Okay.
Prior proper planning prevents piss poor performance.
That's wonderful.
So that was pretty much my motto going into the auditions. And everyone would visit IU. So you would see Tony Niff and you would see Jeff Anderson. So whatever you did in rep class was greater than whatever was going to happen at the audition, because you already competed against the best and heard some of the very best.
Yeah.
Everyone would stop by doing an audition, and it was one of the greatest assets of going to IU.
So you mean like these great tuba players who were going to do an audition would come by and do the audition for the class, or that they would do master classes and you would do your audition for them?
No, they would participate in the rep class.
Wow.
And so, like, for example, I knew Tony was going to win. I literally said, and Jeff Anderson too, when Tony came from Indianapolis, I said, well, unless he has a stroke, he's going to win. I mean, I'd never heard playing like that. And then when Jeff came for San Francisco, I was like, why are we going again? It was that good.
Really?
And this would happen all the time. Like, people would come in. So I also had no fear, maybe because of my street knowledge. When I went to an audition and someone won, well, Steve Campbell, run up. Craig Sutherland won. I would call these people and say, hey, man, can I visit? Can we play duets? And I would go play duets. These people were often very nice. And I realized, I don't think you're that much of a better tuba player than me, but somehow you know these excerpts. And I would learn one thing, like Steve Campbell, I heard his articulations above the staff, and I was like, is that how it's supposed to sound? And so I went and said, it got to sound like Steve Campbell. Or I would hear Tony Niffin play Fountains, and I was like, oh, it really supposed to sound like a waterfall. It's possible. I didn't know that was possible, right? And so every time someone won or was runner-up at an audition, I went to go play duets with them because I wanted to know where my deficiencies were. And without fail, maybe it was one thing or two things, but with every one of them, I learned that, okay, I can do some of the stuff they can do, but here's what I can't do that they can do. And I just started getting better in those areas. And I tell my kids that, man, if someone's winning or someone's making run up all the time, you ought to go play duets with them.
That's a great, you know? Yeah, that's a great idea. Tom Hooton has said, and I think this is really, really mature and wise. He said, you can't win an audition on an excerpt, but you can lose an audition on an excerpt. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Yes, and Mike Roylance puts it this way. No one has ever won an audition by showing the committee what they was trying to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and
that's
Tom
true.
Hooton is such a special player. You know, I was freelancing and recording and playing with Indy when he was there.
Oh, really? Oh, that's right. He was, yeah.
It was clear when he played, you went, he's not going to stay here. Right? You knew that his trajectory was going to elevate. Yes.
We follow Richard's journey as he won a spot with the New Mexico Symphony, and then, when the orchestra failed, how he helped to found the New Mexico Philharmonic, of which he's still a member. Tony asks Richard about his amazing project, the Raw Tuba Ranch, which will be open for people from the ages of 5 to 100. Tony also asks him about his participation in the Slavery Reenactment Project, which changed his view on life. Throughout the conversation, Richard talks about his philosophy of life and his appreciation of hard work with some incredible takeaways, including, the best part about every day is that you're not done yet. To hear the second portion of Tony and Richard's conversation, please consider becoming a contributing listener by clicking on the big blue button on the podcast website to start a free trial. You can also go directly to anthonyplogue-on-music.supercast.com. As a contributor, you'll be able to listen to additional audio content and study up on Tony's podcast Reflections, where he does a recap of his interviews, focusing on suggestions for students. You'll also have access to our Discord server, where you can join an ongoing discussion while meeting and sharing ideas with other listeners. Thank you for listening in, and be sure to help us spread the word.